I've spent the last 40 years teaching international business at the University of California, Irvine. I'm professor emeritus there now. During the 1970s, I spent 9 years as an officer in the U.S. Navy underwater and demolition and SEAL teams. And so I spent some time, I know the military well. Fortunately, that was during the Vietnam conflict, but I was never in the war, and I'm quite happy about that. On the GI Bill, I was able to finish a PhD at Berkeley. My dissertation was on comparing how Japanese and Americans negotiate. And I spent most of the 80s talking about that subject and teaching international business. And we now have four books on international negotiation. I also have a book on international marketing. That's the main subject I teach in the business school. I'm a big believer in the idea that trade causes peace, and as soon as you stop trading, you begin to have problems. The two books I'd like to mention specifically during this period is one called Inventive Negotiation, and that's published with co-authors. If you just Google Graham and Inventive Negotiation, you'll get to the book and the website. And the other book is a new approach I'm taking to teaching peace, and that's a novel, and that's called Charlotte's War. Embedded in this novel is information about peace theory, about there's an analysis of Henry Kissinger's terrible negotiations in Vietnam. There's a lot of material on the topic of negotiation in that book. There's also some romance and humor, which hopefully it's fun to read. They both describe inventive negotiation, which is a very different way of thinking about negotiation. And we might, in a minute, or when you feel like it, talk about how that might be applied in the Ukraine-Russia problem.
Yes, I think that you mentioned two, three very interesting points: trade and, and peace, inventive negotiation for peace, and then, of course, the books. And but I'm gonna start off focusing on Charlotte's novel, and I'm really curious. I'm just looking at the book right now, and the cover page has the picture of this naval officer, his uniform, and then Charlotte's War. And for someone who hasn't really read the book, take me through it. When I'm looking at it, is it a story of a naval officer, or is it a story of Charlotte? Who is Charlotte?
Who is that? We made it a little bit ambiguous, but there are four main characters in the story. Actually, five main characters. Two of them are historical characters. That's Ho Chi Minh and Henry Kissinger. Then the two main fictional characters are Charlotte and her son Jack. And that's Jack's uniform. He's portrayed in the book as a Navy SEAL. Some of that's autobiographical, of course, related to the time. The fifth character that we build and portray throughout the book is television. And television had a big impact on that war, the war in Vietnam, at least in the United States, and affecting public opinion and world opinion and all that. So that's more on Charlotte's War. Really happy with the way the book turned out. It's my first novel.
Take me through the novel. So it's about Charlotte, and what's the story about?
Let me explain. So it takes place basically in the, it's about an extended family, Charlotte's extended family, and it goes back to her parents who are missionaries in China. And that's where she's raised in China. And it runs from basically 1938 until 1972. So her family is trying to survive and get through three different wars: World War II, the Korean War, and Vietnam. So that's the fundamental story. I don't want to give away any of the plot points. I mean, it's a book about peace, but it's a book about the futility of coercion in international relations, and for that matter, interpersonal relations.
I'm going to come back to how the book is used in the current context a little later. I think I'm going to circle back to the novel. And of course, like, you know, I understand you can't give out much, but I really picked up on the fact that firstly, you said it's a book on peace, right?
Yes.
But the title says Charlotte's War. And I was wondering, is it something that embraces the complexity of the war in Vietnam to then harbor peace? Or is it something of Charlotte's personal journey and finding peace? If you can tell us a little bit more about how it's a book on peace, I'm really curious to understand that.
Fundamentally, Charlotte's war is against war. So she is a peace activist, and she's fighting against war and all the forces that are causing those three wars. And so her war is against war. That's the same one you and I are fighting, by the way. Sorry for that tricky title. I mean, the other way the title works, I don't know if you've read Charlotte's Web. There's some interesting themes in both Charlotte's Web and Charlotte's War that kind of overlap as well. But that's where the title comes from. Charlotte is literally fighting a war. She's fighting it in the streets and at the podium. She ends up being an anthropology professor, but she knows Kissinger and Kennedy and other folks like that, and is trying to influence them to not continue the war in Vietnam because her son is facing that problem as the book proceeds. He starts out at age 12, and in 1972, he's about 25.
So Charlotte's husband has gone to the war, her son has gone to the war, so it's kind of her fighting this personal journey of having all her family members at war, so she wants to find peace. Did I understand that correctly?
From her point of view, the wars are completely unnecessary. And one of the things I carefully describe is how Vietnam evolved as a war. And when you look back at it, it makes no sense at all, unless you understand people like Richard Nixon and the great fear of communism, which she learns that was an unfounded fear for the United States, because you can't have a communist revolution unless you have a bourgeoisie and a proletariat. And in the 1950s, when this anti-communism witch hunt was happening in the United States, we had a huge middle class. Communism doesn't work in a country like that. So this whole war, many of the conflicts during the Cold War made no sense because communism was never going to work.
And how come you decided to tell the story of war through a woman's perspective? We don't see that quite a lot. And was it a personal inspiration for this? Or have you been researching on women in war?
Yeah, the the key book that I read that inspired Charlotte and taking a woman's point of view is a book by Steven Pinker. He's at Harvard University. He has many books, but my favorite is one called The Better Angels of Our Nature. And in that, he describes the great peace that we're living in now. I'm going to repeat that because it sounds like nonsense. But he describes the great peace we're living in now. And he emphasizes the importance of looking at trend lines, not headlines. Now, if you read the headlines in the United States, things are awful. We've got kids being killed. We've got this war. We've got the threat of nuclear weapons again. And how could things be worse? Well, they have been worse in the past. All those things have been worse than the past. But the four reasons he gives for the great peace are rule of law. So we have laws now that most people pay attention to, like war crimes laws and things like that. Some don't, including Putin and the United States. The second reason is explanation is rule of reason. We don't have any religious wars. We still have them in the Middle East, of course, but they aren't as frequently the problem. And since everybody has information on everyone else, you can see clearly that some wars don't make sense. And the Japanese knew about American industrial capacity, they would have not started a war with us in 1940. The third reason you're going to like, and that is Pinker finds or reports that when women are in leadership, we have fewer wars. So women have a different view about violence and war and their sons than men do. And that's what I was trying to get at. The fourth reason I particularly like that we have this great peace, and it's because of international trade. And international trade builds peace. It doesn't make peace. It builds peace in three ways. One is it creates interdependence. You've heard that explanation. Interdependence between countries. There's never going to be a war between China and the United States. Neither of us can afford that war. Our economies are interdependent with one another. The second reason is international trade builds interaction between people. And they begin to learn their other cultures and languages, and all that's a good thing. But I think the most important is the third reason, and that is diversity builds creativity and invention. And the best example of that is, I don't know if you have an Apple phone or what kind of cell phone you have, but if you look at the Apple-Foxconn relationship, that's a relationship, a long-term relationship of inventive negotiation where ideas are being traded across borders and across cultures, and it's produced just a fantastic product and set of services. So going back to your initial question, it was really Pinker identifying women as the key to peace. And it's so crystal clear that women think about violence so differently from men. And you know, I get in trouble generalizing. Certainly there are plenty of peaceful men and violent women, but the numbers are quite clear. For example, if you look at homicides in the United States, 80% are committed by men, only 20% by women. Or if you look at the US military, that percentages are the same. About 80% of the US military are men and 20% women. The key is women think about war. They think about their families. They have one family or a few children, and men, you know, we're all over the place, I'm sorry to say. And violence seems like a sensible solution to a lot of things.
That's really interesting. And, you know, you kind of ended it saying women think about war. And I wondered, in the case of this book, what were Charlotte's thoughts about peace and how can you apply that in today's context?
Charlotte, in her advice to Kissinger and other American officials, she's advocating engagement in the way Kennedy did. She worked, have her working on Kennedy's campaign. But I need to go back to 1946. Nixon and Kennedy both were running for Congress after World War II. They were both naval officers. Nixon ran in Southern California, about 20 miles from where I'm sitting right now. And he used a fear appeal about anti-communism. He was afraid of the commies. He accused his opponent, the Democrat, as being a communist. On the other side of the country, Kennedy was campaigning on the United Nations and engagement and world peace. So very different approaches. Nixon was arguing for coercion. And Nixon's approach continues throughout the book, particularly when he's president. He uses this approach in trying to solve the Vietnam problem. He's trying to bomb them into making negotiations agreed to negotiate a settlement in Paris. Kissinger, one of his big mistakes was conflating negotiation and war. He thought they were two parts of the same thing, and they absolutely are not, because war means you're killing people. That's a very different thing from talking or peace talks, as you guys put it. So how does that apply now? Well, I think that we could talk for a long time about U.S.-China relations. I'm happy to do that. One of my books is on negotiating with the Chinese. But I'll go directly to the big question on the table now, and that's, what do we do about Putin? And I think the one thing I haven't heard is, right, if you look at what we're doing right now, we're coercing him militarily, we're trying to, but we've had trade sanctions on the Soviet Union and Russia for decades. They don't work. Trade sanctions don't work. Punishment and coercion don't work. There's great studies done on the efficacy of trade sanctions. Maybe they achieve their stated political goals on 25% of the time, but they ruin relationships between countries. And you know, you've got examples like Cuba, Iran, Russia, China. We've studied negotiation styles in all those countries, and they're actually influenced by being sanctioned. And so sanctions don't work. So the logical conclusion is, you put on the table in the negotiations with Putin, we will drop all sanctions, all trade sanctions. What can you do on your side? Now, this sounds like some kind of insanity, but it's not. The history of trade sanctions, they're used mainly by politicians to demonstrate strength to their domestic constituencies. I'm a tough guy. We're going to put really tough sanctions on Russia. Well, it doesn't work. We're going to put really tough sanctions on Cuba. We've been doing that for more than 60 years. That hasn't worked. Obama was very good about recognizing this. He started to move things along. Trump stepped in and made a mess of things again. And Biden really hasn't cleaned up things in the case of Cuba. He's got a great opportunity, but I'm upset with him about that. But anyway, that's my suggestion. Put that on the table. Maybe it's already on the table in the negotiations, but I doubt it.
You were talking about trade and peace. Is that something you talk about in the book as well, or trade during the Vietnam War, and were there lessons to be learned from then that could be applied now?
Yes, we do talk about that in Charlotte's War. And in fact, the history takes it into account. The final peace agreement for Vietnam included the United States helping to clean up Haiphong Harbor so that trade could run more efficiently. That meant getting rid of the mines. And the agreement required that the United States also support some rebuilding of the Vietnamese economy. Now, that never really happened for a bunch of reasons, but that was in the agreement. But Charlotte talks about the importance of trade and peace, and the idea of building relationships, long-term relationships, of working together. And the most common way that happens is in international trade. Like I said, the best example, if you like, are things like the Apple telephone or the 787 Boeing jetliner, which is built in a large part in Japan. We used to have Boeing aircraft and Mitsubishi aircraft fighting the war during World War II, the air war. And now they collaborate in building 787s. So those are examples of working together in a positive way. And that helps assure a long-term relationship of interaction. Trying to make peace or solve problems or end wars. That's important, of course, but in the long run, it's the relationships between countries. And right now, we need those relationships. We've got huge common problems. For me, the two big threats to peace on the horizon that we can't do anything about, one is climate change. We really need to collaborate on those issues, particularly with China, and we just aren't doing it. The other one is demographics. All the countries are aging fast. And in the United States, we just can't handle the surge of baby boomers that are hitting our healthcare system and our pension systems. And if you look at, you can see it most easily by looking at population pyramids, but Russia and China have worse problems. They're going to have worse domestic problems than we're having right now. And you can just see it coming in the demographics. It's easy to predict.
Coming back to the book, I think I find it quite fascinating that you kind of weaved between history and fiction. And what was that like for you personally?
It was a real lesson for me. There's a lot I didn't know until I did the research about both Kissinger and Ho Chi Minh. And so that was fascinating for me. And it helped me realize why we had that war. At the time when I was in the military, I just wasn't paying attention. I was in my early 20s. And I was drafted. And so I joined the Navy. And I just was not paying attention to what was going on in global politics. And, you know, it's hindsight, great hindsight, right? But anyway, it was fascinating to learn the details about both their lives and how they ended up at odds with one another. The historical context is quite accurate. As soon as you bring in Charlotte or her relatives, then that's fiction. It's fictionalized. There was no Charlotte who negotiated with Kissinger, for example. But it was fun bringing her in and thinking how she might behave. We've also studied how American women negotiate compared to American men. And so we had some ideas about it. But the fun part really was getting to know Charlotte as her character evolved on the pages in front of me. And that was quite a bit of fun. And Charlotte is based an amalgam of women I've known throughout my career, strong women, strong opinions. And so I had some good examples to borrow from. And also Jack, the other main character, a lot of that's autobiographical, but much of it is not. And so it was just describing how history affected him or me, if you like, at the time.
That's really interesting. And, you know, you spoke a lot about negotiations and, you know, Charlotte negotiating with world leaders. And out of curiosity, who is that woman you see, not fictionally, but actually in reality today, who maybe has that capability to negotiate in different polarizing issues and get and find peace? Is there a particular woman or a group of women who you feel have that capability?
Well, a woman that I work with, I've neglected to mention what I've been doing for the last 20 years at UC Irvine. I was the co-director of the Center for Citizen Peacebuilding. And my other director was a woman by the name of Paula Garb. And she's taught conflict resolution and peace pretty much her entire life. She was an American woman that moved to the Soviet Union in the 70s. She's an anthropologist, but she would embody a lot of the qualities I described. And She's retired recently too, but she still writes and works with the Center for Citizen Peacebuilding, as do I. But there are other examples as well. But that's, Paula is really, I think, an important one.
Her name's Paula?
Yes, Paula Garb.
I hope there are more Paula Garbs in the world. And also, what does the book mean for people joining the military and going to actually fight the war? Have you had any of your own friends who are in the military who've read it, or anyone who's currently in the military who's read it or plans to read it? What do you want it to mean for them?
We have had veterans who fought in the war read the book. And in some ways, I know it's troubling, but in other ways, I hope they understand finally the causes for the war that affected their lives so much. A lot of bad things happened in the war. If you talk to veterans, and it was that was before we knew about PTSD and things like that, and the experiences of so many American men in Vietnam were awful. And so I hope it's a bit therapeutic to understand, you know, what the heck happened there? Why did we have that war? Well, there's really no good reason. But anyway, one of my favorite passages in the book is a veteran who describes how in order for him to kill Vietnamese, he had to dehumanize them. He felt uncomfortable killing people, but he was okay killing things. And he describes that in detail in the book, and those are some direct quotes. So that was an awful war, and for so many reasons. And hopefully the book has some therapeutic quality to it as well.
I think there's been a lot of friends of mine who have also been going to the front line. I haven't gone yet, but they haven't. They also say that you just have to sort of dehumanize it to be able to be in that environment. And in this context, there's Charlotte, who's this fictional character. Does she serve as that therapeutic element in maybe her son's life, or even world leaders, or even leaders who are in the war zone? Or is that, do you see women playing that role of the therapeutic role, or is dehumanizing just therapy?
In the example that I just gave, Charlotte is talking to the veteran, and he's telling her his story about killing Vietnamese in war. So that's the role Charlotte plays. She's less advocating and more listening and trying to understand. And what I try to do in the book is present his point of view accurately or exactly. But that point of view is shared by many American men.
You personally were also in the forces, and writing this book, were there any challenging moments for you, if you've been to the front line and how it was? Did it bring back memories, and did the book sort of help you get the closure to the questions you had or the situation you when experienced?
Yes, basically, as a writer, I can only speak for myself, but as you're writing, you're kind of reliving or experiences, or trying to live the experiences of your characters, so that you can write the dialogue and the thinking, and that was very useful for me. It made me rethink some of my actions when I was in my 20s, and I heard it becomes kind of a big joke. One of the things that I have one of the characters say, which I've often said, is the stupidest form of human being is the teenage boy. I still believe that, and the actuarial tables and for car insurance tell the story. The price of car insurance goes down at age 25, but we just are young men. You can't have a war without young men, because wars, people wouldn't go to war. If you look at what's happening in Russia now, the older men are leaving the country rather than fighting in the army. You have to have mercenaries to do that fight. But anyway, that's, you just, as a writer, you kind of review all your behaviors and actions and criticize them and try to understand them better. And so it's a real opportunity in that regard.
You know, for people who aren't necessarily interested in reading about war or peace, and maybe they, you know, they might look at the book on the shelf and looking at the word war might just skip it, because as you said, the headlines these days are just filled with war. And as a person writing about it, I notice, you know, friends itself not necessarily wanting to read the stories because they think it's bad news, they think it's too heavy. In this context, why would you say your book is important for people, and how do you make people care about war? Because maybe by reading, they might want to find solutions to find peace, like ordinary people, not world leaders, not journalists, not just as people on the streets. Why should they read books or read more about war?
I guess the literature has always had books about war and peace and trying to relate how awful it is and how different it is from what you see in movies and things like that, and how different it is from the portrayals that politicians use to sell fighting. I think the book is important for Americans who experience that history. But it's also important to understand what happened if you're a younger American. You know, what happened during Vietnam? It seemed like a long time ago. Yeah, a lot of people died. There were a lot of protests. So what? That's not going to happen again. Well, the point is it can happen again. Although I have to say, I think we, if I go back to Pinker's argument that we're in this great peace, I'm hopeful if we can get through this Putin insanity without real damage done to the world relationships, then we're gonna see, understand the futility of coercion and aggression internationally, and it'll be the end of it. You know, in the last century, we ended things like colonialism, and we ended these wars. And only now do we still see these international incursions and international behavior. And hopefully that's ending, and we can focus more on trying to build peace through trade and interpersonal understanding.